COVID didn't just disrupt schooling, it reshaped how young people learn, connect, and thrive. In this episode, researchers Sarah Walfin and Rob Jagers will join me to unpack what the pandemic revealed about academic recovery, student well-being, and the critical role of relationships across schools, families, and communities. From tutoring and curriculum to mental health, AI, and political pressures, this conversation asks a bigger question. What does it really take for young people and educators to thrive right now? In episode one, we're navigating political tension, rising mental health concerns, and systems that often pull academic learning apart from young people's emotional lives. We talked honestly about the gap between what we know about learning and development from science and research, and what young people actually experience every day. Episode two invites us to take the next step together. This conversation explores what it looks like to support young people's academic, social, and emotional well-being in an aligned manner, especially in moments like this, and how we can build more connected, more coherent experiences across classrooms, schools, families, and communities. Episode two has three parts that will explore how to support social, emotional, and academic well-being and deeper learning in connected ways. You will learn and be able to think about practices that integrate social and emotional learning and academics, and understand why whole person approaches deepen engagement and achievement, and explore principles of application across classrooms and community settings. Organizations, tools, materials, and research will be identified that can help support implementation and adaptation. Part one is an interview with Rob Jagers and Sarah Walfin, who co-authored two of the three papers published by the National Academy of Education. Sarah Walfin is a professor in the Department of Education Leadership and Policy at the University of Texas at Austin, who studies the relationship between education policy and equitable instruction. Robert J. Jagers is an independent senior researcher focused on capacity building of local stakeholders to improve learning experiences and outcomes of young people in underserved school communities. For many years, Rob served as Vice President of Research for the Collaborative for Social, Emotional, and Academic Learning. And before he came to CASEL, he was a professor at the University of Michigan. Part two is an interview with Sophia Rodriguez, who is the co-author of the third paper published by the National Academy series. She is an Associate Professor of Education Leadership and Policy Studies and Sociology of Education at New York University. Her research centers on racial equity, urban education, leadership, and policy. Part three is a discussion in two parts with Joe Bishop and Karen Pittman, who provide commentary on the key issues and application of the three papers. Joe Bishop is the executive director and co-founder of the Center for the Transformation of Schools, located at the School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. That center conducts research that supports school systems and policymakers in their efforts to organize schools around the needs, interests, and talents of young people. Karen Pittman's distinguished career includes 6 years at the Children's Defense Fund, founding and directing the Center for Youth Development and Policy Research, directing the President's Crime Prevention Council, creating and directing the Forum for Youth Investment. She is now a partner at KP Catalysts. In addition to her conversation with Joe, Karen will join the end of the part one discussion. I want to thank you for joining us. The three papers that we wrote were about the wake of COVID and how it is affecting people. And we continue to experience that wake in terms of the consequences in terms of learning and development in and out of schools that young people have faced, but also the ongoing political repercussions that are really affecting what students and teachers are experiencing within classrooms. And the three papers that we are discussing are about three critical aspects that come together when young people learn. It is what they bring as people from their families and from their communities to schools, and how do families and schools connect? What they are in their being and how they're feeling, their well-being in all sorts of dimensions. And schools are about learning and developing key skills that you will use for the rest of your lives, what they're learning. And our conversation is about that. And the first question is about what, from the perspective of your papers and the issues that you were covering, were the effects and what are the ongoing effects of COVID? Sarah, do you want to start?
My co-authors and I focused on the academic programs that were put in place to assist with recovery from what we term COVID slide. So rather than using the term learning loss and leaping into the assumption that students lost learning, we really took the lens that there were gaps and discontinuities in students' learning opportunities, both during the immediate kind of school building closures and rapid shift to online and hybrid formats, as well as in the subsequent years when there were challenges with attendance and even teacher attendance and educator hiring, things like that, and other staffing issues. And so we really jumped in with the lens of how are school systems responding and attempting to close some of these even more widened gaps in academic achievement, and what are the programs they chose to align, accelerate, and extend student learning in the face of these exacerbated gaps from, again, COVID shocking not just students' opportunities within the school buildings, but even in those subsequent years. I think something that we left off in the implications is districts and schools are still attempting, many of them are still attempting to adopt some of these strategies to address student learning, but many have run out of resources and things like that to fully implement a
Would
lot of
you,
the programs that we were discussing.
Rob, from the perspective of the paper you co-authored, what were and what are the ongoing effects of COVID and its repercussions?
Our paper focused primarily on issues of well-being and thriving. The corollary social and emotional considerations that support and synergize to help young people learn and to do well in educational settings. COVID, in many respects, exacerbated existing relational problems in schools, issues of social distancing, the adaptations that schools had to make in order to continue their efforts to educate young people, led to some relational challenges as young people had to figure out how to access learning opportunities. There was significant social distancing and the like. Communities, I think, were essential to providing learning opportunities for young people. Schools, of course, figured out ways to utilize technology, et cetera, to continue learning. However, key aspects of the developmental processes for young people, which include being able to effectively interact with peers and non-familial adults, I think went through significant challenges. And over time, as the social distancing became less prominent and young people and adults came back to school environments, issues of peer interaction, student-teacher interaction were continued to be challenges as young people were re-socialized into the school norms for the ways in which they interact with one another and adults. So you had discipline challenges, you had attendance challenges that Sarah alluded to in her response. And so our paper focused on ways in which programs and practices could be put in place to ameliorate some of those relational concerns to support the kind of holistic development that I think we aspire for young people to experience.
For those who are listening to this podcast, summarize your paper in terms of its underlying messages and what can educators and youth workers do today to start further realizing the implications of your paper?
So, in the paper, Implementing Programs to Align, Accelerate, and Extend Student Learning, Megan Kofeld, Andrew McCatchen, and I begin by briefly sharing some quantitative evidence on the effects of COVID-19 on educational inequities for our K-12 students. And then we selected and highlight three promising academic recovery strategies, which were extremely common across the United States in districts and schools. So, the first strategy we attend to is the selection and adoption and implementation of ELA curriculum to align and accelerate learning, with many states and districts offering incentives for the selection and use of high-quality instructional materials. The second strategy, which we discuss, relates to high dosage tutoring. And there we discuss some of the initial evidence on the nature and design features and effects of a few different types of tutoring, which is meant to accelerate student learning and also extend their opportunities for learning, particularly in the core content areas. And last, we turn attention to evidence on design features and some early evidence on the effects of summer programs, which similarly are attempting to accelerate and extend students' learning opportunities. We then discuss that regardless of the strategy adopted to accelerate and help close these educational inequities in the wake of COVID, that it's necessary to pay attention to the evergreen implementation issues. And so these are the implementation factors and barriers that are shaping how these strategies take root and whether or not these strategies contribute to positive effects for students and for schools. And so, first, we discuss how context matters and the when and where of implementing these strategies matter. Then, we discuss how an array of resources shape whether and how these strategies are implemented in a deep and sustainable way. And last, but perhaps stretching across all of these, we discuss how coherence matters in and for these strategies, and even across these strategies, and thinking through, for instance, what is the coherence between ELA curriculum and tutoring and other initiatives that are happening within a school that shape students' learning. I appreciate the opportunity to think through what are the on-the-ground implications for both current and future implementation of these strategies. And I think that one point that stretches across is thinking deeply about how to build the capacity of both teachers and leaders in a meaningful way on these various strategies and really explaining the rationale for adopting a new curriculum, offering time and active learning opportunities for leaders and teachers to understand what does it look like to do tutoring in a way that's engaging and relevant for students and that also boost student outcomes in a way that aligns to various goals of the education system. What are the learning opportunities that prepare and support leaders to understand how to partner with community organizations so that they can select and then boost the implementation of summer programs, again, that make a difference for students, that meet students' needs, community needs, et cetera?
In our paper, David Osher, Wayma Jones, and I discuss the ways in which school programs and practices can support the thriving of both students and educators. We spend some time defining what we mean by well-being, distinguishing well-being from thriving, and discuss school climates in which schools can either support or undercut the well-being of both young people as well as educators. We then turn our attention to programmatic efforts that support the development of mental health, well-being, and thriving, both in students as well as educators, as we see the pivotal connection between the way in which adults show up and the way we experience the learning environment. In our treatment of the various programs, we leverage the evidence that is available, pointing to universal programs like social and emotional learning. We also discuss multi-tier student supports, trauma-informed practices, and really tie it all together with the treatment of school-family-community partnerships. In each instance, we try to provide examples of programs that exist that have evidence of their effectiveness in promoting well-being and thriving in young people. Community schools, I think, is the best representation of a full suite of these kinds of programs being offered. And we focus on implementation as a key factor in whether or not these various programs and practices are effective and achieve their goals and objectives. We highlight ways in which schools can engage in practices that allow for small wins, build towards these more comprehensive programs, focusing primarily on peer-to-peer relation and student-teacher relationships as fundamental building blocks in moving towards some of these more comprehensive, complicated, and resource-intensive efforts that sometimes schools find to be not, don't see them as feasible. And so we highlight some of the small wins that allow for short-term confidence and planning towards these larger scale efforts, which in total provide for more well-rounded experiences for both young people and educators. In our paper, offer definitions of well-being and thriving, which we see as intimately connected with well-being, the being the baseline, and thriving being an enhanced way in which young people and adults experience the world and interact with others. We offer various examples throughout the paper of the types of programs that layer upon one another to ensure that all young people get what they need when they need it in the learning environment. And we end our paper with examples of a coherent implementation of this broad array of programs and practices, focusing on one district where they have been able, through sustained systematic work, to put in place the various pieces that evidence has shown can be enacted to ensure that all young people grow and thrive. Finally, what schools can do today to begin the process is really engaging with young people, caregivers, and concerned community stakeholders in ways that invite them into the learning process, understanding that all learning is relational and that establishing and growing trusting relationships is foundational to working with people and adults in all school communities. We offer examples and evidence for an array of programs, starting with universal programs that all young people receive, building on that, discuss multiple tiers of student supports, and emphasize the need for a relational approach to EMTSS to ensure that people experience the various supports in ways that they are valued, seen, and heard.
I wasn't one of the people who were on the committee that commissioned the papers when the papers were commissioned, but they were an idea that was appropriate and still is appropriate and were generated in 2020. In addition to the powerful consequences of COVID and the powerful political processes that are going on right now that are very disruptive in schools and communities, we have the consequences of artificial intelligence and the increasing use of AI-informed chatbots, and how that affects and is being utilized by young people who already, even before COVID, were doing more things online, both affirmatively and sometimes problematically, and you utilized it more during COVID. If you were writing your paper and you also were including the impacts of web-based technologies and their further spread, and artificial intelligence-empowered large language models that are friendly to people and can be used by people, on how young people approach learning and are affected by learning and engage in learning, and how they feel about themselves and others. How would you add to the paper?
In our paper, we paid particular attention to the adoption and implementation of ELA curriculum as well as high dosage tutoring. And I want to focus first on the high dosage tutoring because in the early phase of recovery from COVID, it actually turned into a bit of a test case or sandbox for some of the sort of AI and chatbot use of technology in schools for tutoring. So a subset of districts adopted tutoring programs that included either virtual tutoring or some tutoring that included programs that were using AI modeling and systems. And this was a bit before everybody under the sun was using AI for a variety of purposes. And I think there's an argument to be made that this open policy window and the additional resources for districts to go to these vendors that were using AI-assisted tutoring and different forms of academic remediation programs really was a test case or a sandbox for AI in schools. Also, flipping just this use of ELA curriculum as a way to align and accelerate students' learning opportunities, we're now, and this is somewhat anecdotal, but this has been in some different data collection that I've done over the past couple of years, we're beginning to see more and more educators using ChatGPT and other tools for their lesson planning and finding different ways to incorporate. So even if they do have a core adopted ELA curriculum, they are then doing kind of adaptations and modifications with the assistance of AI, including ChatGPT, to ask, okay, if I'm in this unit and I'm trying to teach and cover these standards, what are my extension activities? Or generate a worksheet that would do this and this for my students, or my student population involves this and this. How else do I extend or adapt what's in my adopted program? It's impossible to think about, particularly the implementation of these various academic programs, without taking into account the broader sort of political environment that they're situated in, and obviously that schools as organizations are situated in. I will point that, in particular, the selection and adoption and implementation and monitoring of ELA curriculum is and has been and will continue to be politicized. And by politicized, I mean that there are sort of state level and even district level committees that are reviewing ELA curricula with a particular political lens in mind and seeing and viewing this selection process as a way to shape and select what are the sort of reading materials in schools, what topics teachers will be covering or not covering. So, in a sense, the selection process in certain contexts has turned into a censorship process and a censorship sort of mechanism. More broadly speaking, the selection process is a control of what is covered within schools and the nature and voice of educators' work and the voices of particular teachers in particular contexts. And then, obviously, the voices and experiences of students in particular contexts. And so I think as we think about this, there is or was a framing that states and districts are choosing particular ELA curriculum as a way to boost achievement. And at the same time, that frame was able to hide or turned into a Trojan horse for these ELA curricula are also shaping teachers' work, controlling teachers' voices in many ways. And then as a subsequent step, controlling kind of the ideas and information that students gain access to within our public education system.
Great, Sarah. Rob, any thoughts on that?
Emergence of educational technologies, I think, has been a concern for those folks focused on social emotional learning and development for some time. With the evolution that has occurred with AI, I think you have both benefits and concerns that have emerged, especially around the mental health implications for vulnerable young people. So there are both positive and negative issues associated with some technologies that have not been well tested as it relates to social emotional learning. There are individualized learning opportunities that feature technological advances in mentoring, relationships between chatbots and young people that have emerged but have not been adequately interrogated for the process and outcomes that you get when young people without adult supervision are being exposed to AI or to chatbots. And there are privacy concerns that have emerged, informed consent concerns that have emerged as well. And so while AI represents a potential boon for the ways in which individualized learning plans, both academic and social and emotional, can be put together and implemented, there are also these lingering concerns about the ways in which the programs themselves are formulated, what the inputs are to create the programs, and then the informed consent concerns about having these technologies accessed by young people. It's related in some ways to the broader social media concerns because, as many of us have come to understand, learning occurs everywhere. And so there's the formal learning focused technology work, and then there's social media that is broader, unregulated in many respects, where young people are being exposed to messages that one might consider questionable, in some ways unhealthy as it relates to their mental health. So there's been significant work around the mental health implications of this broader kind of social media domain that we would want careful attention to. And thus far, I don't think we've been able to effectively do that. You also ask about the broader context or the more current context of violence. And I think that there are challenges to young people's well-being and thriving with the emerging economic precarity, as well as the political divisions that we find being very prevalent, and especially the political violence that has emerged. And those are additional impediments to cultivating well-being and thriving in young people and adults. As we look for remedies for learning lag, both academically, socially, and emotionally, and rely more and more on technology, we can't forget the relational aspect of healthy development that is imperative, but can get lost in our effort to utilize technologies that tend to be relatively individualized or privatized.
As we talk about this political environment, I'm really glad that Rob mentioned the magic word of privatization. I see that also as a theme that stretches across papers. And as we're thinking about the impacts and how our education system and educators within them are operating, it appears that we see privatization coming up in these strikingly different and pervasive ways. So, again, seeing sort of how software companies and vendors and textbook publishers and other sort of private entities are really shaping experiences within schools and what counts as schooling and who is putting more pressure on educators and shaping what educational experiences look like. And that could be in the academic sphere or the non-academic sphere. And these things all are braided and woven together, but there are these private forces that are pushing in.
And that's a great point, Sarah. I appreciate you raising that or extending that point because that's the place at which, David, you're concerned about young people seeing themselves in curricula and leveraging existing assets from family and community context becomes a kind of a central concern because often this privatization is not rooted in those lived experiences and subsequently negates or ignores the community realities that young people navigate and draw on to become healthy and well functioning.
These are very important and good questions. 2 Januaries ago, the authors of the three papers came together as we were starting to do our work, just to hear what each other's were doing. And then, just as teachers often do in classrooms and as youth workers often do in communities, we went into our own little cubby holes and we wrote together and produced three papers. They're all connected. And so, if we were to come back together, having read the three papers as we all have, what are the common messages? What are the common challenges? What are the common potential solutions that people can take away from the three papers? Sarah?
I noticed that across the papers, there's a lot of attention to what happens when the rubber meets the road. It's an implementation story versus a story about just particular programs, just particular instruments. It's much more about how do we think about and strengthen and improve the infrastructure for schooling? How do we think about the substrate in which everyone can thrive and work in sustainable ways and learn in sustainable ways. Again, whether they are community partners, district leaders, principals, teachers, the students themselves, families. Across multiple papers, there's rich attention to the context and the resources that are necessary so that people within the context can. I really think that the people are at the core of all of these papers. It's not just about the resources that are flowing or not flowing into schools. It's not just about particular ideas, or this is the one way to teach math, or this is the one way to use AI or not, or this is the one way that we should have cell phones in schools or boost attendance. But instead, it's really attending to, at the end of the day, there are going to be people that in interaction and in a particular context are making these in the moment decisions and continuing to learn and continuing to help others learn within our education system.
Rob?
Yes, I would agree that what I would frame as a relational context for learning is a kind of a cross-cutting theme. The notion that family schools and communities are all contexts in which learning occurs, and that the more synergies that can be created across and within those institutions, the better served young people and involved adults actually experience the learning process, both academic, social, and emotional. And that it's core to healthy human development. And all the papers tended to hit on that set of issues in one way or the other.
As I listen to you, I also hear something that was a theme in Sarah's paper, which is coherence. And I think we're talking about coherence is more than programs, coherence is more than a space, it is across the spaces. And what I also hear is something that is in the second paper, which is about engagement. How important it is for people to be actively engaged, and that one of the consequences of COVID and the political process has often been to create ways in which people disengage, whether the disengagement is cognitive and emotional, or whether or not it's physical. Any thoughts on that, Sarah, Rob?
Yeah, I think of schools really as civic institutions, right? Microcosms in many respects, and microcosms of the broader society. And so they are places situated in communities where people can come together to actively participate in the furtherance of the evolution of a healthy democracy. And engagement becomes critical so that your voice is heard and so that you hear the voices of others, and that we utilize our assets to help young people thrive, to become the best individuals and groups that they possibly can. Your comment about engagement, I think, is a central concern, especially in these political times where division and alienation and exclusion are all too prevalent.
Karen, you've been listening to this conversation. What do you think?
We've been reflecting on the impact of COVID and AI and politics on schools' ability to engage young people, to looking at things. And you've both talked about this idea that it's really about infrastructure, it's implementation. How are things being implemented? So I'm wondering for both of you, as you reflect on the changes that have happened over the past couple of years, do you see changes in school leaders' interest in connecting with or recognizing the value of community organizations and community partners that are the other places and settings where young people spend their time? Has there been any shift in those relationships?
I would say that in some instances, you see that kind of shift. In other instances, retrenchment into kind of a narrowed notion of what academic learning ought to be, inclusive of more stringent notions of what curricula is, who is a learner, who is an educator, et cetera. So there is some narrowing in some corners, and in other school communities, you find a broadening and appreciation and a learning from the COVID experience, where in many instances it was those community institutions that were organized to support the well-being of young people, while schools, in some respects, were not able to fully operate as they would have liked to. So I would say there are some bright spots in terms of that broadening. And in other places, less bright spots, let's call them.
I strongly agree with this sort of bright spots and some challenge points or areas for opportunity for both district and school leaders and how they're conceptualizing and actually partnering with various and engaging with various community partners. One point that we discuss within our paper is this notion that certain districts and schools did lean on community partners as one type of provider for tutoring to help extend learning opportunities for students. That was not everywhere, but that's one bright spot or example where certain districts chose to engage with and identify community partners that could provide tutoring services and service tutors for their students and on their campuses. And secondly, similarly, certain districts and schools' summer programs were braided with and carried by community partners. And so again, there was a sort of engagement with community partners through that the district and school leaders were working on. In both of those cases, we also there's some evidence that both district and school leaders were so overburdened with sort of other aspects of staffing and other sort of new questions and challenges in the wake of COVID that they had trouble finding kind of the time and bandwidth to identify and engage with these community partners. And so, again, I think there's that tension of how much is on leaders' plates. And to me, it raises the question or it becomes important to think about at what point do we find ways to take things off of district and school leaders' plates so that they have the time, the energy, the bandwidth to work with these community partners in a way that provides kind of continuity and that has multiple benefits for schools and for students and the communities themselves. One addition is as we think about staffing challenges and educator turnover and educator churn, there's considerable evidence that there was a lot of churn in district and school leaders over this time period between 2021 and present. And so, as we think about these engagement opportunities between district and school leaders and community partners, that stealing Rob's beautiful sort of relational and relational context term, if there's that turnover and churn, then the relationships are new and a little more tentative and are not as baked in and institutionalized and don't have that deep trust and forms of communication there. And so that makes that sort of partnering between leaders within educational organizations and community partners, I would argue, both more time consuming and again, less deeply tied and less routinized.
I want to thank you for a very informative and provocative discussion. It raises a whole array of issues that the next 33 podcasts are actually going to be elaborating upon. For example, as I listened to our conversation about what is needed across the schools and across the communities, it's about readiness. It's about the readiness of leaders to relationally connect with each other and have the time to connect to out-of-school organizations, community organizations. It's about the readiness of teachers to be able to be present with students. And it's about the readiness of students to be able to be present with the teachers, which is not just cognitive readiness, it's emotional readiness. It's the grounding and connections that they have within their families. Thank you very much. In part one, Sarah Walfen and Rob Jaegers helped us see the system, the strategies, the pressures, and the challenges of making learning, well-being, and implementation work together in a moment shaped by political tension and rising mental health needs. In part two, Sophia Rodriguez asked us to look more closely at the people, whose voices are centered, whose knowledge counts, and what becomes possible when youth, families, and communities are treated as partners, not as problems to be solved.
There's a river.
There's a